We're doing the parsha. It's Parshat Chayei Sarah. So Avram got up early in the morning to take Yitzchak to the Akedah, to the binding. Sarah shouldn't change her mind. They're telling Sarah that they're going out to learn Torah. They're telling Sarah that Yitzchak finally is going to go learn by a Rebbe. It's time to send the boy out at 37 years old. And instead, Avram takes Yitzchak for the binding, and Sarah gets word that her cherished only son was taken up to be slaughtered, and she dies, as pious as she was. And so Avram comes back from the Akedah to find his wife deceased. And if the Akedah was a challenge, then this is a brand new challenge where Avraham has to contend with the idea that his wife is gone. Chazal say, "Ein ha'isha meta ela lebaala." The one who suffers most when a woman passes is her husband. Above and beyond that, Avraham has to contend with the idea that she passed away when he wasn't home. He was out doing what God asked him to do. And now Avraham has to deal with the idea that Sarah passed away to some degree as a result of the Akedah. What guilt? How do you deal with that? So let's zoom out of the picture and get a bird's eye view on the planet. Let's go up to Shemayim. And let's see the records. When Sarah was born, what did it say in God's plan? When was she supposed to die? On what date was she supposed to give her neshama back to heaven? Irrespective of that Akedah, every person that's born is given an allotted amount of time. Hinei tefachot natata yamai. King David says, God, you gave an exact measurement to my life. I know that you know exactly when I'm supposed to die. Now, that doesn't mean that if a guy goes speeding with his Ferrari off a cliff, they're going to say in heaven, he was supposed to live another 30 years. No, they're not going to do that. You know, we do have the capacity to shorten our life. But in general, there is a time when every person must go. So in Shemayim, it was written when Sarah was born, that she would live to this age, to this time, to this day. Sarah was supposed to pass at age 127. But that's not what Avram sees. What Avram sees is she heard of the Akedah and she had a heart attack or a stroke or something and dropped dead. Very often in life, we're given a small segment of the picture and we have to deal with it. Did Avraham know that in God's plan she was going to die now anyways? If he didn't do the Akedah, she would have had the same heart attack. He didn't know that. Did Avraham necessarily have an answer? Why did Sarah have to die? No. Part of dealing with life is that we don't always have answers to our questions about God. If God sent me to do this, then why isn't everything working out right? When I was a kid, there was a Disney song. I don't know. What's about you? Why do they make things like they do? If they made things like they should, everything I tried would turn out good. And then the song goes on and describes how he cleaned up the kitchen floor, the bottom to the top, but the soap suds got above him, so he couldn't find his mop, so he didn't know. Why is it that if he put so much soap, you could have bubbles that cover everything, right? So as a kid, you hear this song, and it's an interesting song, like, Goofy keeps messing up, but he always wonders, if they made things like they should, everything I tried would turn out good, right? But it doesn't work that way. And we even go God's path. Avraham Avinu does exactly what God told him, and suddenly seems to backfire. His wife dropped dead. It's pretty bad. And you'll notice that Avraham's tests are repeatedly along this theme. You know, one of the greatest fears a person has is for his family. When a mafioso wants to threaten something, every person knows they're vulnerable. How far can you protect your family? Avram is sent to the land of Canaan. Let's start with Avram being thrown into the furnace. He walks out alive, but his brother is burnt to a crisp. His brother's dead. Haran. We know behind the scenes that Haran was wavering. He didn't really have faith in God. Haran said, I don't know if God's for real or not. Oh, Avram walked out alive. Fine, I'm with Avram. So they say, okay, let's see. They throw him into the fire and he's burnt because God doesn't do a miracle when you do it for the sake of a miracle. Haran wasn't like Avram. Avram said, either I live or I die, but God is one and he's for real. Haran didn't say that. Haran said, I'm not sure. Let's see what happens to Avram. When Avram walked out alive, he said, okay, I'm with him. So they said, let's see. They threw him in. He didn't come out. Avram is sent to Canaan. There's a famine. He goes down to Egypt. His wife is abducted. Same thing happens again. Yishmael is sent away. The tests revolve around the most painful points. Avram can't have children. Avram's wife can't have children. He has to marry the maid. Suddenly the maid's son is problematic. The son has to be sent away. It doesn't get more painful than that. Finally, God tells Avram, take your own son. Now you're going to do it. Can it get harder than that? Yeah. When he comes back and he stood up to the test and he finds his wife died. So on every front, Avram suddenly has to deal. And you know what? Sarah's not coming back. Not until Trias Amesim. How do you deal with that? And the answer is, a person has to be willing to accept that he doesn't have all the answers. When you build the understanding, I didn't say faith, understanding that God runs the world, so then he doesn't owe us answers and he doesn't necessarily run the world the way we would like. There are many things, many times when a person would like to sing that song. Very often when I'm cleaning, I think of that song. If they made things like they should, everything I tried would turn out good. Yeah, but it doesn't. We live in a world where we have to deal, and we have to deal when we don't understand. Avram is not given the insight that we're given. Oh, he can have a hunch. Maybe Sarah was supposed to die today anyways, and maybe not. And again, the same theme we stressed the last 2 weeks comes to haunt us again. There is that thundering silence from above. Hashem does not come into Avram and say, hey, Avram, don't worry, she was going to die anyways. No, on the contrary, Avram has to deal when he's not given the answer. Yes. Yeah. Yaakov.
Are there any other midrashim about this that paint a different chronology?
Sure.
Do we have to accept this one?
No.
What's another one? An alternative.
Look at the Rishonim on the spot. It's not so clear. Last week we discussed that we're missing 35 years in the story. Meaning Yitzchak is 2 or 3 years old when he stops nursing and we have the party. And then over here, Yitzchak is 37 years old. And the question is, where did those 34, 35 years pass? So Chazal tell us they passed before the Akedah. But reading the text, you don't have to assume that that's what happened. It could very well be, and here again you have conflicting midrashim and conflicting opinions among the commentaries. It could be that Yitzchak was 11 or 8 or 12 when the Akedah happened, and then you have another 15 years, 13 years before, or 23 years before Sarah's passing. The question is, Vayavo Avram nispod l'Sarah v'livkota, Abraham came to eulogize and weep over Sarah. Where was he coming from? So Rashi goes with the Medrash that he was coming from the Akedah, and it was her hearing of the Akedah that caused her to pass, and other commentaries go differently.
And then there's the Ibn Ezra doesn't go with
right.
37.
Right. So then many years would have passed. They'd have lived a life, a nice old age. Right. There's a very striking Medrash that says that as Avram was binding Yitzchak up, Yitzchak started saying to Avram, Dad, do me a favor. When you're going to tell mom, be careful. Make sure she's sitting. Make sure she's not standing by a well. Make sure you break the news to her slowly. Like he's giving his father instructions, you know, I don't want mom to lose it when she hears about it. I'm not sure how she's going to handle it. A whole midrash about their conversation and Yitzchak's thought how to break the news to his mother. Coming back to our parsha. So Sarah passes away and she's in Kiryat Arba, according to the simple reading. She's in Kiryat Arba because she was an old woman and she needed good air, and Kiryat Arba is elevated so she could have good air over there. So she was out on vacation trying to regain her strength. And Avram comes either from Be'er Sheva or from taking care of the cattle, and he comes to eulogize Sarah and weep over her. And our sages say that this is a gift that God gave the matriarchs, that none of them were widows. They all died before their husbands. So none of them had to contend with life without a husband. The husbands, they got remarried, they dealt. But for the wives to be left alone, to contend with being a widow, to contend with all the nations all around and the people trying to steal their wealth and the chinuch of their kids. So this was a gift God gave the matriarchs that they all passed away first. To eulogize and weep, to eulogize and weep. That's a skill that we have to learn. We have to learn how to eulogize and we have to learn how to weep. Very often we hold our tears in, and when we're called upon to eulogize, we don't know how to do it. And it's a skill we have to learn. I would mention it first with regards to Shiduchim. Our parsha is the parsha of Shiduchim. Avram is getting a shidduch for Yitzchak. One of the points that people find difficult is describing someone to a prospective shidduch. You get a phone call, can you describe your roommate? So what do people say? The first thing most people say is, I'm not so good at this. Try it, you'll see. Most guys and girls, the first thing they'll say is, you know, I'm not so good at this. Get out of here, come on, that's a cop-out. Stop, think, and start saying nice things. That's ridiculous. You can't speak nicely about a roommate? So then we have to work on ourselves so we could speak nicely. He's a great guy. He's a very fun roommate. He's sincere. He's dedicated. He wakes up early. If he doesn't wake up early, find something else that's nice to say about him. You know, he's easygoing. What?
He wakes up alone.
Right. He never lets me feel like I'm the last one out. You know, find the nice way to say it. Okay. So that's not the point to stress, but you should be able to say a lot of positive things. And if we don't, then we have to work on having those positive things. So Avram comes to eulogize Sarah and weep over her. And you'll notice the order is first eulogize and then weep. A proper eulogy arouses people to weep. Very often, people weep, but they don't know how to eulogize. So sometimes when a youngster passes away, it's easy to weep. And then there's not so much to eulogize. When someone old passes away, so most people come to the funeral and say, okay, at 127 years old, well, she wasn't going to live forever. So no one wants to cry. So that's where the job of a person giving a eulogy is to arouse people to weep. And Avram teaches us that one has to learn to compartmentalize. Dale Carnegie, in his book, How to Stop Worrying and Start Living, so he describes that in the submarines, they divide the submarines into compartments. They have huge ships. The Navy has huge ships that go out. And the idea is that sometimes a ship gets a hole in one part of the ship. So they compartmentalize. They have automatic doors that shut. And that way, even though one side of the ship has water gushing in, the rest of the ship can stay afloat. And in life, we have to do the same thing. Sometimes a certain aspect of life is problematic. Something sinking, there's a problem. And a person has to know to put that on the side and be able to deal with the rest of life. So Avram just lost his wife. His son doesn't have a wife. He's an old man. If she's dead, what's going to be with him? He can't worry about everything right now. Right now he has to deal with one thing. He has to deal with getting a proper burial place and burying Sarah. My father words it differently. My father says sometimes in life when there are tragedies, a person has to put on blinders, just like a horse, right? You put on blinders, he doesn't look to the right, he doesn't look to the left, he just charge forward. So sometimes in life, you got to put on blinders and deal with the task at hand. This Matzei Shabbos, I met one of the soldiers who I had the merit to learn with last year, and he told me that he just finished a course of bandaging, of being a chovesh, of being a paramedic, a first response out in the field. So I said to him, you got to be prepared that when blood is gushing and the guy is wailing and he's flapping his hands all over, you have to be calm. You can't get scared. There's going to be noise. There's going to be gunfire. There's going to be a lot of pressure, and you're going to see your best friend lying there yelling and crying and jumping all over from pain. And you have to be very focused. You have to ignore any feeling at that moment. Your job is to be the surgeon to save his life. You have to stop, think what's important, and deal. And in life, we have to know how to do that. Sometimes I told him a story. One of my children had a circumcision on Shabbos, and I let a student do most of the circumcision. And then there was the final part, which I had to do, because it was on Shabbos, so he couldn't complete it. And because the actual circumcision passed hands between his hands and my hands, so there was much more work to do than ordinarily. And I'm looking there at my newborn son, and I know that I have between 1 minute and 2 minutes worth of cutting that I have to do right now, and I have to ignore the crowd and ignore the baby, and the best thing in the world that I can do for him right now is work. I said to him, you know what? The sweat is dripping down, the tears are dripping down, and I have to be focused and do what's right. And if I don't, I'm not doing him any favors. So that's what I did. What choice did I have? But in life, we don't have a choice. Sometimes life throws things at us, and you deal. Avram has to deal. The Torah tells us, Vayakom Avram al penei mito. Avram gets up, Sarah's lying there, the corpse is lying there, deceased, and he's going to go start doing business. Business? Yeah, you got to do business. The people of Chet have gathered to do kindness to bring her to burial. And in those days, they had no concept of an afterlife. So sometimes they would barbecue the deceased. Sometimes they would make mats out of the skin of the deceased. Sometimes they would cremate the deceased. They did all kinds of things with the body, but no one had a concept that you have to bury. They used to make vessels. They used to make, vessels out of the bones. And they'd use them, he's still with us, right? So Avram is coming to them with a new concept. We're going to make a burial plot for the family, and we're going to honor it. And they tell him, you can choose. Any burial plot we got is fine by us. Anyone will let you bury wherever you want. And Avram understands what they're saying. You'll bury just like the rest of us, in the middle of a field where she'll be plowed on, or somewhere else. It doesn't really matter. And Avram says, look, I appreciate it, but if you want to help me, then I want to make an achuzat kaver. I want to make a place that will be a cemetery for my family, a continuation. And he's teaching them a lesson. A human being that dies is not like your donkey that dies. He needs a burial, and he needs a place that we as a family know that that's where the person's buried. Now, in last week's parasha, when the three guests come to Avram, so he wants to bring them sheep, and he wants to slaughter a sheep, and the young sheep runs away, and he chases after it, and his circumcision is bleeding, and it's painful, and he chases some more, and the sheep runs some more, and finally, he catches up to the sheep, and it goes into a cave. He goes into the cave after the sheep, and he sees a candle lit. That's strange. He walks into the cave, he sees two candles and two bodies lying side by side. It's Adam and Eve. Adam and Chava are both lying in the cave buried, and there are candles next to them. We are told that that is the miracle of Maris HaMachpelah, that Maris HaMachpelah is built in a way that there are sets, there are pairs, there are engravings for pairs, meaning in the wall there's an engraving for a man and an engraving for a woman. and Adam and Chava were buried there. And when Avram sees that and he smells the wonderful smell of the Garden of Eden in there, he realizes it was no coincidence that he found that cave as he was chasing the sheep. He was being led there. And from that day onward, he kept in mind, I want to buy that cave. And he never told anyone anything about it. So now he comes and tells the people, I want to buy the cave that's at the edge of Ephron's field. And Ephron is there, and Ephron says, no, I'll let you take the field, I'll let you take the cave, everyone sees it. You can bury her and everyone's witness. Avram never asked for the field. But Ephron figures, I got him cornered in front of everyone, what's he going to say? So Ephron says, sure you can have the field and the cave. We'll do our business deals later. And Avram says, thank you very much, but I want to pay full price. You tell me and I'll pay. And Ephron says, what's 400 silver coins between good buddies like you and me? And with that, he jacks up the price tenfold. And Avram has no choice, but at least Avram pays up front when everyone's present. And this is one of the things that people tend to overlook. Very often you're about to cut a deal and you agree on it and you say, okay, I'll pay you. And then when it comes time to pay, the other party says, hey, wait a second, but you were supposed to add this, you were supposed to add that. Make sure you get everything clear and if possible, you conclude it on the spot. There shouldn't be room for claims. I was once selling a car. It was the lousiest car I ever owned. It was previously a taxi. But it had two good things about it. It had one of those huge mirrors where you could see all sides. And it had a jack that must have been worth at least half the price of the car. So I was selling the car for $400. Now the jack in the back was worth over $100 and the mirror was worth $50. I didn't plan on selling him the mirror and the jack. But I didn't take it out when I showed him the car. I should have taken it out. Now comes time to pay, and I'm going to take out the mirror and the jack. And he says, wait a second. I thought the mirror and the jack were included. And I'm thinking, wait a second. You're buying a car for $400. You thought I'm giving you $200 worth of paraphernalia with the car for $400? I didn't have any more time left. I gave him the jack and the mirror. But I was wrong. I should have taken it out when I showed him the car. When you come down to the actual payment, very often there are misunderstandings, and we don't always understand, even with proper intent. We don't always perceive what the other side is taking for granted in the deal. So Avram doesn't tell him, you know what, I'll bury Sarah and I'll get back to you with the money. No, he says, fine, right now I'm paying up front. And they go to the field and they actually show, they delineate what parts of the field Avram's getting and what where the cave is, and Avram's getting all that, and he pays up front. And then, only when he's finished with the business transactions, only then does he bury Sarah. There's an interesting medrash. I wouldn't address it ordinarily, but you might hear it quoted, so you should at least hear a pshat in the medrash. The medrash says, God blessed Avram Bakol with everything. So one medrash says he had a daughter named Bakol. Another medrash says Avram was blessed that he didn't have a daughter. So people like quoting that medrash, right? We were all boys in the family, so people liked quoting us that medrash. What's the medrash talking about? Why is it a blessing not to have a daughter? So the commentaries explain. In those days, it was very hard to find a fitting guy for your daughter. If Avram would have had a daughter, then it was highly unlikely he would have found a fitting suitor. You see who Avram was dealing with. It was hard enough finding a match for Yitzchak. Now to find a match for a daughter, the Medrash is saying that it was a blessing to Avram that he didn't have to worry about two shidduchim. You see, it took him 40 years to find the shidduch for Yitzchak. So to find the shidduch for a daughter would have been even more difficult. So Avram calls in his old servant, the one who's really in charge, and he tells him, we're going to make a deal. I'm giving you and all my assets over to my son Yitzchak, and you're going to go out and find a wife for my son Yitzchak. Promise me you're not bringing me one of the Canaanite girls back.
According to the medrash, he had a daughter with the name of who was the mother of this daughter?
I don't remember. But I think it is addressed. We have to look it up. I don't remember, but I think it says Beferush one way or another. In the commentaries on the Midrash.
The Sarah, the daughter of Sarah?
So that's what I don't remember. I don't remember. We have to look inside. I don't remember. But I do remember that it's addressed. So we have to just look it up. I don't remember what it says. But remind me Thursday. During the break we could go look it up. So Avram is concerned on multiple levels. One of his concerns is that he doesn't know if he's going to live. He doesn't know if he's going to be around by the time the servant comes back. And one of his concerns is that Yitzchak has to function on home territory. The girl has to come here. He's not going there. He blesses the servant and says, God should send his angel before you. Which angel is this? The angel of dreams. So as Eliezer, the servant, is headed out to Haran, Lavan and Besuel, and the whole family is having weird dreams. They're having dreams that Rivka's going to get married and her shidduch's on the way, and they weren't even thinking about it yet because she was so young. She wasn't yet of marriageable age. She was still nursing. So they take a vow. And Eliezer takes 10 camels. Avram's camels are unusual. They go around with a muzzle, so they shouldn't eat from something that's not theirs. And they're traveling. You notice they shouldn't eat from something that's not theirs. There are many stories about rabbis who sat with their students, and the students suddenly picked some leaves off a branch and started picking them off, or picked some grass and started tearing it up, and the rabbi looked in horror, and the student said, what did I do? And the rabbi said, that's not your tree. Why'd you just destroy a branch or pull off leaves or pull out grass? So we tend to underestimate this, but a person should be sensitive to what doesn't belong to them. So Eliezer, even though he's traveling, and technically the camels have to eat, but he's ensuring, as Avram would ensure, that the camels don't eat from what's not theirs. Okay, they come to the city. And Eliezer is very, very smart. He's Avram's top servant, which means he's a big businessman. And Eliezer knows that he has a challenge here. If anyone sees him with money, so then whenever people see money, they like money, so people are very nice. If Eliezer goes into people's homes, so then next to their parents, girls behave very nicely. They know they have to behave. So Eliezer figures the best way to see the girl that's right is to stay out of the city and wait till the girls come out. And the girls would go out and draw water at the wells. Very often, guys would start up with the girls at the well, and let's see how they deal. I often recommend that on dates, you go for walks. Go to the Kotel, go to Ben Yehuda. Go to places where there'll be action. You want to see how she reacts when a beggar comes and doesn't leave you alone. When a woman or a man, you want to see how she reacts when she has to deal with the real environment of the world, not the sterile environment of a hotel lobby. Go out. Go and say, yeah, there'll be problems and see what happens.
How she reacts to the waiter.
How she reacts to the waiter, right. To the waiter or the waitress or the little kid who falls and hurts himself in the park. Or the little kid that gets lost, or there are a million circumstances. Go deal with life. So Eliezer is waiting out there by the well, and Eliezer does something wrong. Eliezer turns to God and says, let's make a deal. I'll wait over here. The girls will come out. I'll ask the girls to give me a drink. And whatever girl says, sure, mister, you take a drink and I'll give your camels. That's proven that she's the right one for Yitzchak. Really, how do you know she doesn't have a glass eye? Maybe under her long blouse she has a wooden leg. Maybe there's a million problems with her that you're not going to see as she's offering you and your camels a drink. So Chazal say this was a mistake. Eliezer is making this deal with God. And who are you to make a deal with God? Now we have guys, wise Alex here, who have tried the same thing. You know, God, the first girl that agrees to go out on a date with me, I'll marry. Now you make it the right one. Then they come to me and ask me, should I have married her? I don't know. You know, I don't know who told you to make such a deal. Did God come in and say yes? Even about Eliezer, the Talmud says, Shlosha shalu shelo kahogen. There are three people who asked improperly. One of them is Eliezer. What are you doing making such deals with God? Did God say, yes, you're lucky, God gave it to you? But technically, by what right? So Rashi gives us a whole different pshat in what's going on here. But the Talmud tells us it was wrong. So he was lucky. In heaven they agreed. And Rivka comes out. She's from the right family. She's the right girl. She's good looking. She's a virgin. She was never intimate with any man. She had everything right. And he runs towards her and says, give me some water. And she says, drink, mister. And she gives him to drink. And then she says, I'll give your camels to drink too, until they're done. And she empties out the remnants of her pitcher, and she goes and draws more water for the camels. And he's watching. So many years I told the story of Donald Trump and his limousine that broke down, right? Has any of you heard previous year's classes? Donald Trump was driving upstate New York, and his limousine broke down, and there was massive traffic. It was one of those late Friday afternoons, and a Hasidic Jew stops his car, and he stops by the limousine with all the smoke puffing out, and he says, let me see if I could help you. And he goes with the driver, pops open the hood, and works under the hood for a half hour, 40 minutes, and Mr. Trump comes out and he says, you know, I already ordered my people to come out here. And he says, look at the traffic. What are they going to do? Come by helicopter? We're going to work it out together. And he fixes the car and they're up and running. So Donald Trump looks at him and says, sir, how can I repay you? So the guy says, don't bother. It's fine. People help one another. I'm happy helping you. I got to go home. The Sabbath is coming. Sunset soon. So he says, no, I got to be kidding. What do you want? So he says, I don't want anything. I'm happy helping a fellow human being. Good luck and goodbye. So he runs after him as he's trying to get into the car. And he says, tell me something. So he says, okay, you know what? Because I was here, I didn't get to buy my wife flowers for the Sabbath. So I'll give you my address. If you can make a phone call and have them deliver flowers for my wife, that'll be nice. So he says, fine, that you got it. He gives him the address. And the guy drives off in his jalopy and he's headed home. And Donald Trump gets back into his limo, and he's headed his way. The guy comes home. They're in a rush getting ready for Shabbos, and suddenly the doorbell rings. The doorbell rings. His wife goes to answer. There's someone standing there with a huge, beautiful bouquet. So she's shocked, and he's smiling in the background. He's not going to tell her anything. And then she puts down the bouquet. She takes out the card. She opens the card, and the card says, Mister, I don't know you, but your mortgage has been paid. Donald Trump. So the moral of the story is, if you're going to stop and help someone at the side of the road, you better hope it's a limo, right? So that's the joke, right? But to some degree, it's not such a big deal what Rebecca's doing. She sees all these camels loaded with jewelry and wealth. And, you know, it's like stopping and helping the limo. Right. Her brother Lavan would tell her, you know, don't help all the other guys. Help the guy who's got camels loaded with jewelry, right? But let's understand what's going on here. You have this big muscle man named Eliezer. He's a formidable enemy. According to Chazal, Eliezer was such a warrior that he single-handedly could take down whole armies. Eliezer was you got to think truck driver, right? You're talking about 7'5", you're talking about muscles packed out to here. And he runs over to her and says, girlie, you got a drink? So she could have said, hey, buddy, there's the well. Get yourself a drink. What do you want from me? No, she gives him a drink. Now this three-year-old is going to go and start fetching water for 10 camels? How many camels is that? Okay, so let's say she was 14. Two opinions in Chazal, whether she was 3 or 14. But okay, so it's a lot of work for a young girl. It's carrying a lot of water. And why? You know, we have a mitzvah in Torah. Help a person unload his donkey or camel, but do it together. You know, he's sitting on the side watching her. Good job, right? What do we see here? And that's why we have to appreciate what kindness is all about. True kindness doesn't factor the other side. Meaning, if I'm going to start thinking, why don't you do it for yourself? We had a guy who, he told the story. They were married a few months, and one day they're sitting at the table, and he suddenly notices his wife says, could you pass me the pitcher? And the pitcher was closer to her than it was to him, you know. He had to get up and walk 3 feet. She just had to get up to get the pitcher. So he gets up, walks the 3 feet, gives her the pitcher, and doesn't say anything. A few minutes later, the same thing happens a second time, and a third time, and a fourth time, and a fifth time, and he's not going to say anything. He went to these Binyana Bait classes. He says, I'm not saying a word. Okay. Fine. But he's wondering. And she's not saying anything, but she's asking him for all these seemingly unnecessary and simple favors. And after a few days, she shares with him that she's having these dizzy spells and these massive headaches, and she could barely stand up and walk. And then they go to a neurologist and they start doing tests to see what's wrong with her, like why she was feeling this way. But he didn't know that. They were newlyweds, and she wasn't comfortable telling him all this. She kept thinking, it'll pass, but she kept asking him for these small favors. He didn't understand why she's asking for them, but he said, she's asking, okay, I'll do them. It seemed easier for her to do it than to ask him, but if she's asking, he does it. Only later did he start understanding where she was holding in life. Kindness is about the willingness to help without asking oneself, hey, maybe they should really be doing it for themselves. You could always say that. You could often say that. If he's asking for the help, Sir Rivka says, okay, I'll help him. Obviously, there's a reason why he wants my help. And so Rivka draws the water, and we have to figure this took her close to an hour. In the heat of the day, she's going and drawing more and more water, bringing it to the camels to drink. And when she's done, so he gives her gifts. And then he asks her, who's your father? He made a mistake. Should have asked the question first. If you're so convinced, so ask her. And she says, I'm from Besuel. I come from the main wife, Milka, and there's plenty of food and plenty of hay. You're welcome to come home. And here we see that they ran a home where the children knew that the parents welcomed guests. The house of Besuel, like the house of Avraham Avinu, was a house that welcomed guests. One of the things you should discuss on your dates is what kind of home do you plan on running? If you're in shul and you see a Machon Meir guy, can you invite him? Or do you have to check with your wife first and then invite him only for the morning? Now, it seems simple, but it's not so simple. Figure you're newlywed. For you and your wife, you make 2 pieces of chicken. You have a guest, that's another 50%. You have 2 guests, that's double the expense. It's double the expense, it's double the work, it's double the shopping. You know, when you have a big family, so then you always have an extra piece. When you don't have a big family, so then it's a question of attitude, and it can be a significant part of one's budget. So Rivka knew that she can invite someone, that her parents would be happy with it. That teaches us something about the home of Besuel. So he blesses Hashem, and he is headed home. Now Rivka's brother Lavan comes running out, and he sees all the money. So he comes and blesses him, and He's very excited. Because he figures if there's money, he's going to get some, and he's going to figure out a way of bumping off Eliezer and staying with all the money. So Lavan and Besuel decide they're going to put poison in Eliezer's soup. So they put poison in Eliezer's soup, and they tell him, have a bite. They figure they're going to stay with all the wealth. So Eliezer says, I can't do that. I have to talk first. So they say, okay, you got to talk. So he begins and says, I am the servant of Avram. We tend to hide our blemishes. And Chazal said, we learn from Eliezer, put the things on the table. I have a very good friend who needs a shidduch. And he's missing an arm. So initially when I try to set him up, so I'd say all the wonderful traits he has, and then in the end I'd say, you know, there's one more thing I didn't tell you yet. The guy is missing an arm. He was born missing an arm. And I didn't succeed in getting him set up so well. And then a friend of mine's wife, who was also trying to set him up, told me, it's not the way to do it. You got to work the other way. I said, what do you mean? She says, when I call up a girl to set her up, I say, Chava, I want to set you up with a guy that has only one arm. Now you'll ask yourself, why do I want to set you up with a guy that has only one arm? So let me tell you more about him. But I begin with that. I put that on the table. Then I could tell her all the other things. You know what? Ever since I worked her way, it works. We've gotten the guy set up. There were girls who wanted to marry him. We learn it from Eliezer. Eliezer begins the speech. He says, I am the servant of Avram. He puts the facts on the table. He puts his blemish on the table. And one application of this is when someone comes and asks you advice and you know that you're partial. You have a roommate that's been driving you crazy. But you haven't said anything. And then he comes to you and says, you know, I wanted to ask your opinion whether I should switch rooms or not. And you're thinking, great idea. But you, okay. You've been telling yourself you should buy your friend's laptop. You know that that's an exceptional laptop. You can't get such a laptop here for those prices. And then he comes to you one day and says, you know, I was wondering if you think I should sell the laptop. So you're thinking, be honest. Put the facts on the table. You want, I'll try to think it through with you. But in all honesty, I would love to buy such a laptop. So I am impartial. I am partial. We once had a store. Wasn't really a store. We tried to have a store, which we then sold. So a friend of mine was considering buying it. And I said to him, first thing you got to know is that I'm partial. I want to sell, so I want you to buy. So you're going to ask me questions. I'm going to try to be honest. But at the end of the day, I am partial. We learn from Eliezer. If there's an issue, put it on the table at the beginning of the conversation. Yes?
How is being servant of Avraham Avinu a flaw?
Because he walks in and they treat him like a big boss. It's as though all this money is his. So he could mention it at the end of the conversation and he chooses not to. He's putting the facts on the table. I'm not the boss here. I know it seems like I'm the boss, but I'm not. So he tells them his mission and they're thinking that he will eat and drop dead and then they'll stay with his wealth. And it doesn't work. We have a tradition that the angel comes and switches the bowls of soup. And Besuel drinks the soup with the poison and doesn't live out the night. Besuel's dead that night. There's a more complex medrash about Besuel and his vile deeds and the danger to Rebecca. If he would have lived through the night, she wouldn't have made it as a virgin back to Yitzchak. That's a complex medrash. At any rate, we learn from this story how disrespectful Lavan was. They ask the question, and Lavan answers before Besuel. And even though it seems to be a pious thing, they say God's arranged all of this, nonetheless, it's disrespectful that Lavan speaks before Besuel. He doesn't belong in the conversation altogether. The halacha says, Nechos kibud aveim, that for a son to even say, Dad, you're right, is disrespectful. Because he's saying, I can tell you whether you're right or wrong. You got my approval. Yeah. Good job, Dad. No, it's not a son's job, and on the contrary, it's disrespectful. Yeah.
Seems a little bit out of character. When the first thing, Rivka wants to bring guests home, they used to have guests, and then think nothing of trying to murder somebody for their wealth. And then after passes because of the poison of the marriage. I mean, what would prevent Lavan from, you know, he's already usurping and disrespectful now when his father's gone, to make sure Eliezer, you know, meets an untimely end. I mean, it doesn't really gel with, you know, being hospitable as to the fact that they wanted this family, as much as we see it has certain blemishes. Abraham said, you know, won't give me a woman from the Canaanites, give me this family. So in some way, they were right. The idea that they would try and murder him So the money is a little bit out of character, even though, as we learn later on, some of you issues.
I hear, but we find that when it comes to money, people do funny things, sure. Even kind people.
And I used to have a guess like that. Okay, fair enough. Make him be swayed.
So, after the meal, the next morning, Eliezer says, let me go. And they say, no, stick around for a bit. According to some, it could be that they were planning on bumping him off in that time. And Eliezer says, no, I got to go. This is a success. Let's close the deal. And they say, we'll ask the girl. And they assume that she will refuse. She just lost her father. She's going off into strange territory. She doesn't even speak the language. They say, you want to go with this guy? So she says, yeah. So they send her. And they bless her. And from here comes the custom that we bless a kala when a kala goes off to be married. The Sfardim have a custom that they actually read in the Torah sections of the blessings of the Torah on the Shabbos when they have a kala or a chasen present. Some have the custom that they tell her this pasuk, Achotenu atayile alfei revava. They even have a song revolving around this pasuk. The ancient custom among the Ashkenazim was that the rabbis would go to bless a kala before she went off to the chuppah. That was the ancient custom of the badekin. What we do today, that the chasen comes and puts the veil over her, used to be the elders who would come and bless her. And the Yekis still have an offshoot of this custom that when they come to do the badekin, to put down the veil over the kala, so the chasen puts down the veil, and then her father blesses her, and then the chasen's father puts his hands, he doesn't touch her head, he puts his hands above her head and gives her a blessing, the same blessing we do on Friday night. Yisimcha Elokim, Kesera, Rivka, Rachel, Vele'a, Yivrecha, Shem Yishmerecha, etc. So, our sages say that this blessing had an impact. Chazal say, Al tehi birkat ediot kala beinecha. Even the blessing of a simple person carries weight in heaven. So Rivka travels, and she's traveling behind Eliezer with her girls, with her wet nurse, and Yitzchak has gone to go and pray for a shidduch. Where does he go to pray? He goes to Har HaMoriah. He goes back to the Temple Mount, that same place where he was offered, or he was almost offered, and that's where Yitzchak is, Lasuach Basode. They're crossing the Temple Mount, and Yitzchak is up there on the Temple Mount praying to have the Shidduch. What a Shmona Esrei. Could you imagine that? It's the late afternoon. He's davening for the right wife, and he looks out to the sunset, and there she is. Okay, so Rivka looks out and sees Yitzchak, and she tips herself off the camel, and as she goes down, she wounds herself, and she's bleeding, and she looks out to Yitzchak, and she asks Eliezer, who's that? And Eliezer says, that's my master. So she covers herself, and from there we have the custom that a kala, before she meets the chasen by the chuppah, covers herself, puts the veil over herself. So Eliezer rides forward to Yitzchak and tell him everything about what a great girl she is. And that's the job of a shadchan. People think a shadchan's job is over after he offered the girl to the guy to the girl. No, a shadchan's job is to keep them excited. You got to tell them good things about one another. A shadchan's job is to get both parties excited to date and then to keep them excited and help them see things in a positive vantage point. Very often, I ask to speak. In most scenarios, I do not ask to speak, but when it comes to the meals of a Sheva Brachos, so there I find myself often asking to say a few words. Why? It's not because I feel like I have such words of wisdom or words of Torah to impart. It's because the idea of the speech at Sheva Brachos is to point out to the couple positive attributes that either side have. And very often I'll be present at a Sheva Brachos where people are giving fantastic Divrei Torah and they say nothing about the Chasen and Kala. And when I see that happening, so then I ask if I could say a few words. And I don't talk Torah. I get up there and I talk about what a wonderful guy he is and whatever positive things I can think of to say about him and whatever positive things I can think of to say about her. And that's my Dvar Torah, because that's really the idea of the speeches in Sheva Brachos. We say a little bit of Divrei Torah, but we're supposed to say a lot of words of praise to help the couple look at one another positively. It doesn't come naturally. You could be married to the greatest person and you won't notice it. You'll notice the few things that are off. And during the Sheva Brochos, we try to get them accustomed to seeing the positive in one another. So that's what should be in the speech. You got to be able to say nice things about both sides. When Rivka falls off the camel and she's wounded, so there's an interesting medrash which we discussed at length in our Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer class about how she loses her virginity when she falls off that camel, and then Yitzchak suspects Eliezer when Yitzchak discovers that she's not a virgin the first night, and then the medrash discusses how Eliezer says, "I didn't do anything, and if something happened, it must have been when she fell off the camel." And Yitzchak goes back out to where she was when she fell off the camel, and a deer comes and uncovers what bled over there. So there's a whole medrash about that, and that's why the deers get a special mitzvah, that their blood gets covered when they're slaughtered. The parasha tells us that Yitzchak brought Rivka into the tent, and he loved her. And this is a classical concept that's reiterated many times, that we find that the love of Yitzchak developed after they were married. Very often people think they can love a person before they're married. And it's almost impossible. You barely have anything with the person. When you guys will be dating, so you should know, you have to take time to date. I'm a fan of a minimum of 30 dates. But you have to realize that there comes a point in the relationship where the relationship will either take off or self-destruct. Take off can only happen when there's that commitment of engagement towards marriage. If you don't get engaged, at some point the relationship can no longer advance. As Orthodox Jews, you're not touching, you're not sleeping together. There's this tension that's in the air, and the relationship cannot go any further at this point with all the constraints that we have. A relationship reaches a point where it can develop beautifully, but only if you let it by getting engaged. Yitzchak loves Rivka after they're married. True love comes as marriage develops. Through marriage, you learn love. What you have beforehand, that's not love. That's a lot of other things. It's not love. As you develop your life together, their love develops. And so you have to remember, you need to take the time to date. But you also have to realize that when you reach that window of opportunity of engagement, don't imagine that it'll last forever. It doesn't. I've seen many a couple that were holding by that window and for all kinds of external reasons said, "Well, wait, he wants to finish his army, she wants to finish her degree," and many times it self-destructs. Now, you can't have a long engagement period either. Engagement can last 3 months, 4 months. You want to extend it a year? It's rare that the engagement lasts. It's rare that the couple really can be engaged and get married in the end. Usually, again, it self-destructs. In ancient times where they didn't have internet and email and SMS and phone conversations and they weren't seeing one another for a year, so then yes, you could have an engagement period for a year. In our day and age, it's rare that it lasts. Usually it doesn't work. And we're up to Shishi where Avram remarries, but people have comments. Yeah.
Earlier mentioned that Eliezer did something wrong in asking God for a sign.
The Gemara says it.
I don't understand why that would be the case, because it seems that the very, very exceptional people, they're expected to have an understanding that God is looking out for them. So one of the reasons why it was counted that Abraham Avinu made a mistake in going down to Mitzrayim. Faith in God that he would remain in Eretz Israel and do okay because of who he was. You just mentioned that he followed a lamb that he was going to be shechting into the cave, and that's where he found Kibar Adam Rishon, Shanah, buried there. If his the wound of from circumcision was bleeding out, I'm a normal person, that okay, let the thing go and do first aid. And not trust to something like that. But for him, we're not saying, wow, that seems really ridiculous of you to put chasing after land that you've probably got 5,000 of them or something to go and do this. So we see that there is something more expectations. And for Eliezer, who is working on behalf of Avraham Avinu for his son, who is just like him, and they're, you know, some of the most amazing people who ever lived, and he himself, at least according to Sunday Darshim, never died. He was so great, and he could fight entire wars by himself, and he was, all this. Makes total sense to, God, I want a miracle. I'm that, this is that important, or I'm that great, or I'm working for people that great, that you totally expect something like that. And maybe it means that, we shouldn't follow that advice or something. I really don't understand how that could be the case. How could that be the case? That's my question.
You're presupposing that when Avram ran after the lamb, his bleeding was such that he should have stopped. I don't think so. I think that had Avram bled to the point where he needed first aid, he would have stopped and dealt with it. It wasn't that he was counting on a miracle in order to chase after the lamb. It's that it was painful, but it was to a point where he could handle it, and it was worth it for him. He wasn't about to let that lamb get lost and suffer, etc. He was about to take that lamb and do the mitzvah he was supposed to with it, even though it was painful and he was bleeding. But it wasn't at a point where he should have done first aid, because then he would have stopped and done first aid. We don't usually ask God for signs and tell him, work according to to what works for me. Even Gidon, who asks for a sign, asks God if he can ask for a sign. And that's what we find later in Tanakh as well. To come and say, God, I'm going to make this condition and you work on my terms. That's not usually the way things work.
Was
Yiftach, and it was Shaul. Correct. Those were the three.
So Gidon was fine in asking.
Because he asked God if he could ask for a sign. He didn't come and tell God, I'm going to do this and this such and such. That's very different. To make an open-ended condition with God is one thing. To ask God if you could have a sign is another thing. I don't think that you can compare. And the fact that someone's great doesn't mean that he could say, God, I'm just going to do this, and if it's right, it's going to work. You can try, but you have no guarantee that God will play according to your rules. You see, in Yiftach, it backfired. You see, Chazal used the terminology shalu shelo kahogen. They asked improperly. That's not a way to ask. I could give you more examples. I mean, there's a story about one of the rabbis who appointed his son to take care of the workers. And midday, the workers came and said, we're hungry. So the kid said, what do you mean? They said, your dad always gives us to eat. He said, I don't have any food. He looked at the tree, and the tree didn't have fruit. So he said, tree, please give us your fruit. I have to feed dad's workers. So the tree miraculously bore all these fruit, and the workers had a lot to eat. And when his father came home, so his father heard the story, and he looked at the son, and he said, oh, you really asked God to work so hard on your behalf? And the kid dropped dead. Boom. Not exactly what you'd expect, right? The kid is such a tzaddik, he could get a miracle, and his father looks at him and says, why do you think that's right? So obviously the story needs more work. When we'll get there in our Ein Yaakov class, we'll discuss it with more depth. I'm just saying, don't take it for granted that just because a person's a tzaddik and might merit to have miracles, that means that it's right to come and demand them or to say, I'm going to do it, and God, you just make it work. No, that's we don't find Avram doing that. We don't find Yitzchak doing that. On the contrary, we find them working to make something work. And Chazal point out that what Eliezer did over here was Shal, Shelo Kahogen. He asked him properly, and he was very fortunate that it worked out right. The Talmud said he might have ended up with someone who was not as good as Rivka. Now, the truth is that there's a point we didn't go into, which is, what would be so terrible if she had a glass eye? What would be so terrible if she was missing a leg? If she's a wonderful person, then what's the problem? So that really deserves a discussion. Meaning, the Talmud says it as an example that he might have been misled. But the question is, would that really be misled? I'm saying, so if she's a fine person, what do you care? A person of Yitzchak's stature cares if she has a wooden leg? What difference does it make? So that deserves another class. I was hoping you guys would ask so we could expand on it, but no one asked, so we'll wait with that. Yeah?
So is it better to assume that God would rather not do miracles and have us just play along, so to speak?
Yes. God says, I gave you a world deal. Don't expect me to get involved and make everything work out right for you.
Start babysitting.
I wouldn't use the term tired, but... God does not give us the guidebook. He does not tell us, here's how you can control me. He gives us the guidebook how we should live our lives. But he doesn't give us the guidebook and say, here, you can tell me what to do and it'll just work. And people think that if they're pious Jews, then they can make it work. You know, the Talmud says, you want to know what's an amulet to ensure that your prayer does not get answered? Daven really hard and be confident that because you daven with so much kavana, it'll come true. Then the Talmud says that's a guarantee it will not come true. Wow, wait a second. I thought prayer works. The Talmud says, yeah, but that doesn't mean you can stand there and think, if I daven really hard with real focus, for sure God will do what I want. No, that's a way of ensuring it doesn't. The Talmud goes so far as to say, let's say you davened, and thanks to your prayer, it started raining. So you lifted your eyes to heaven and said, thank God. Wow, I davened, so it started raining. So the Talmud says the rain will stop. The Talmud says, if you were the one whose prayer caused it to rain, and then you patted yourself on the back and said, okay, it worked. Okay, so then God will, so to speak, make it work differently.
That goes back to arrogance.
That goes back to arrogance, right. Right. Okay, so we'll continue here, Bezalel Shem, on Thursday.